This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's recent interview with Bobcat Goldthwait and Barry Crimmins. Goldthwait and Crimmins are good friends who each became important in the 80s comedy scene, and both have been through a lot of changes since. Goldthwait was first famous for his manic persona, for which he used a high-pitched, screechy voice. Many people know him from his role as Zed in the Police Academy films. Goldthwait has since dropped the persona and become a director of independent films and TV shows, including Jimmy Kimmel Live and Marin. His new film is a documentary about Barry Crimmins. In 1979, Crimmins started a comedy club in a Boston Chinese restaurant called Ding Ho. A few years later, he founded another Boston comedy club called Stitches. Many comics got their start in Crimmins' clubs. It wasn't until the early 90s that Crimmins revealed that he was raped several times at the age of 4 or 5 by a man brought into Crimmins' home by his babysitter. After going public, he started exposing pedophiles in internet chat rooms. Part of Terry's conversation with Crimmins and Goldthwait may not be appropriate for young children. Goldthwait's documentary about Crimmins is titled Call Me Lucky.
Bobcat Goldthwait, Barry Crimmins, welcome to Fresh Air. Bobcat, I'm going to ask you to start and to introduce us to Barry Crimmins. For people who don't know his comedy and his place in the comedy world, just place us for us.
Well, Barry is a mentor of mine and a guy who I really look up to. His place in the comedy world is he's been an influence on many comedians that are really popular and well-known. And he started the comedy scene that was in the late 70s, early 80s in Boston. He's a political satirist. He's quite brilliant. And I'm not sure. I think he's a Gemini. I could be wrong.
Barry, you started two comedy clubs in Boston. In 1979, you opened a comedy club within a Chinese restaurant called the Ding Ho. And then a few years after that, you started a comedy club called Stitches. And Bobcat, did you ever perform in either of those clubs?
Oh, sure. I bombed in both those venues. I started doing comedy when I was a teenager with Tom Kenny, who is the voice of SpongeBob. I don't want to name drop, but and I've known him since I was 6. Tommy and I saw an ad that Barry put out in Skinny Atlas, New York. We went. He put us on stage. It was bold of him to put some snarky teenagers on. And then when Barry moved to Boston, I actually followed him there, and that's where I got my start doing comedy. And you know, in my stand-up act back then, there wasn't material even. You know, I'd go on stage and cry and read a Dear John letter or gut fish on stage. And let's just say the other club owners weren't really excited about what I was doing. Barry and my act couldn't be further from what Barry was doing on stage, but Barry encouraged it. And you know, he just encouraged me to be as odd and as in what interested me as a comedian.
I don't think I've ever heard the expression gut fish before.
Well, you know, I would just say that, you know, I'd come out of the character that people know me for. People would say, stop doing that character all the time. So I went on stage and I said, hi, this is my real voice. This is who I am. This is the part of the show. I like to gut and clean a fish. Does anyone have a fish in the audience? And my roommate Dan Spencer would pull out a fish. And here at the Ding Ho, this fish was a little rancid from being in the trunk of a car. And I opened it up and then there was immediately the smell. A woman in the front row vomited. There was fish entrails.
Oh, gosh.
And then a friend of ours, Bill Campbell, who does observational humor about relationships, had to go on stage after me with all this fish guts and vomit and
odor.
Barry, did you talk to him about that afterwards, about not wanting people
laughed.
To vomit in your club?
I laughed, but I can't. I might have been somewhere. I don't think I was there for that one.
Well, Shun Lee, who owned the club, came up to me and he just said, "Bobby, you weird. You weird."
So, Bobcat, for people who don't know how you sounded on stage back in the 80s and who don't know the kind of persona that you had then.
Sure.
I am now going to play an excerpt of something you might not remember.
I remember.
Okay.
I'm sure.
In 1987, Bobcat Goldthwait was a guest on Fresh Air. I was not hosting that day. This was my first.
It must have went really well that I'm back now.
How many years did it
later,
take?
Here he is.
Return triumphant appearance.
So just to set the scene, it's like the show had just gone national in May. It's now August. It's my first week away from our new national edition of the show. Leanne Hansen, who later becomes the host of Weekend Edition on NPR, is filling in for me, and you're going to be on the show. I'm on my way to Cape Cod, tuning in the radio, and here's what I hear. Leanne Hansen is introducing Bobcat, and it's just like long intro detailing his career, a little bit about his early life. It's really in detail. So here's the tail end of the intro. Here we go.
Goldthwait gained the nickname Bobcat during his mischievous teen years, and he first began writing comedy material right around the time he reached puberty. And he was already performing in clubs when he was 16 years old. Bob Goldthwait, welcome to Fred.
Well, thank you very much. That was quite an elaborate research. I feel like I'm dead, actually. In fact, if I did die now, it'd be pretty good, because that's not a, you know, outside of being in the police lobotomies, that's pretty an impressive, you know, array of things.
That's a good resume. You gave me an A on it. You gave me a little star.
Yeah, I didn't mark it and correct it. I guess that's kind of rude of me. Actually, thank you very much. It's really nice to be on Fresh Air, something I've never been accused of, you know.
Okay, let's go back.
Let's bring it right to the toilet immediately.
I'm actually embarrassed. And also my voice was higher. I mean, not only the character, but my voice was higher.
No, but the character. Like, how did you come up with that voice for your character?
Well,
I just back announce that tape. So that was Bobcat Goldthwait on Fresh Air in 1987 with Leanne Hansen guest hosting, and me listening in the car driving to my vacation and thinking, what?
Did you turn around? Did you go? I got to put an end to this.
He is really hard to interview, I was thinking.
Yeah,
I thought, this is going to be a rough ride.
Well, my heroes growing up were people like Andy Kaufman and Groucho Marx and people that very rarely drop the persona. And I'm a very private person and I use this persona to hide behind. And it was something that started when I was a young comedian working with Barry. I actually, the first time, I think it was this guy who had seen Bigfoot and went on stage, I think at the Under the Stone where we started.
Yeah.
So
it's my hometown.
It just became more and more easier for me to hide behind this persona. But, you know, I used to direct the Jimmy Kimmel Show, and I'd done that for years, and I was going back to doing stand-up, and I really hated the idea of doing stand-up again, and it hit me, it wasn't the comedy clubs, it wasn't the traveling, it wasn't the wacky morning radio shows, it was like, I hate this persona. And so I had to jettison it just for my own sanity.
What did you hate about the persona?
I didn't realize I hated it. I think it was a bit of a backlash for me because, you know, people knew me from Police Academy and things like that. And I sound like I'm tooting my own horn, but there was always content underneath it that I think isn't remembered and isn't even put in perspective.
My guests are comics Barry Crimmins and Bobcat Goldthwait. Goldthwait has made a new documentary about Crimmins titled Call Me Lucky. Bobcat Goldthwait, why did you want to make a film about him?
Well, I've always wanted to make a movie about Barry. I'm jumping ahead of the story. When he was testifying, after he testified on a Judiciary Senate committee against internet child pornography, it was a real cap-brass kind of thing that happened. And he really was amazing. And that was the germ of the idea. I originally wanted to make a narrative movie where someone else was playing Barry, and I because I didn't want Barry to have to relive the events of his childhood, and so it became a documentary. Only recently I had struggled with getting a screenplay made, and so Robin Williams was my best friend, and he was a big fan of Barry's and knew Barry's story. And he suggested that I make this movie as a documentary. And in fact, his involvement was how the movie got started. You know, he gave me the initial money to start filming it, which was just two Februaries ago. And that's how this movie all came about.
And Barry Crimmins, how did you react to the idea of a documentary about you, a documentary that would include you talking about being raped as a child?
Well, I have no problems talking about it because I've kind of learned not to be complicit in the crimes that were committed against me. And so I was happy when Bob called and said he wanted to do a documentary, because trying to make a narrative about it was pretty complicated, and I took one swipe at a script form. I guess you can't have a 340-page script, so
yeah, people frown upon that.
I tried to be inclusive.
It opened with him on a jet, and I was like, well, okay, I can't afford a jet. so we're already in hot water. I'm used to making my movies for very little money and way outside the system. So there was going to be a lot of problems making it as a narrative. But I had heard Barry on Mark Maron's podcast on WTF, and then I heard him on Dana Gould's podcast. And I when I heard him talking about the events, I often as his pal, when we would talk about these events, I would see him go into some forms of shock. And when I heard him discussing these things, and I felt it was almost ready to pull the trigger on Barry doing a documentary, because I felt that he could be in touch with these things, but I didn't feel I would be putting my friend in peril and asking him these questions about these very hard events.
Barry, you were known for being a very angry comic on stage, for sometimes heckling the audience, for sometimes berating other comics for being shallow. So now it's assumed that the anger came from having been raped repeatedly as a child. Do you think that that's true? Do you think that is the source of the anger?
Certainly a source of some stuff. First off, I didn't berate that many comics, really. I mean, I would...
I don't know. In the movie, it seems like you did.
I would give them some... Well, yeah. It's not the whole... I mean, there were no cameras at the Ding Ho at 10 o'clock in the morning when I was talking to them on the phone, So, but, after three shows on a Saturday night, some guy comes in with a camera and I was relaxing by then. But I really didn't. I mean, I think you can see how many good friends I have who are comedians.
Oh, no, absolutely.
So I didn't. I would try to convey vital information to them at times and just insist on originality. That was about as tough as I got about berating anybody. I just didn't want other people doing other people's stuff. I wanted original stuff at my club.
And Barry, the fact that not being derivative was so important is why he was responsible for this greenhouse that started so many people with completely unique, different styles. Barry was there, helping people like Stephen Wright and Paula Poundstone get started, and Lenny Clark, Steve Sweeney, Kevin Meaney, all these folks, Dennis Leary. And because there is an emphasis on being original that came from Barry, that's why there was so many different kinds of comics that were original that came out of that scene. I will say, in his defense, Barry never attacked the audience first. It was always he was never first blood. He wasn't like a guy.
I was never one of those guys. Where are you from? What do you do? Harassing someone in the front row because they've got a funny looking shirt on. So, I would like to, but going back to, because this is a very important question Terry asked, I'd like to think that I would have been upset and angry about many of the social issues I've been upset and angry about, whether or not I'd been raped as a child.
So Barry Crimmins, let me just ask you a little bit about those formative experiences when you were repeatedly raped by, was it your babysitter's father?
It was some sort of relationship that wouldn't have been made clear in the late 50s, but probably like a boyfriend or something of the kid's mother. And she would come over for a while, and then this guy would show up. My parents would, he'd make sure my parents were clear of the house, and then he'd show up. And I have no animosity in my heart for the babysitter, because I'm pretty sure it was me or her. One way or the other, she she wasn't compliant, you know, with setting me up because it was her idea. She was a young kid, and I always wondered what happened to her.
Yeah, I certainly wonder that too. Was there anyone you could tell or ask to protect you?
I was pretty young, you know, so and then really put into shock. So I guess that's why. I mean, I can't really figure it out to a T. My sister did end up protecting me when she finally discovered it. She made a run for it, and, you know, the babysitter.
She walked in on you as it was happening.
Yeah, well, she came down. Yeah, she came down the basement stairs. In my head, I always had this picture of her being caught by the foot. You can see in the movie, at one point, I'm looking at the stairs, and that's just really vividly coming back to me. The thing I always remembered was her being caught, you know, and she was trying to go get help. But in the end, she did get help. It ended up being this thing where my parents didn't find out what happened, but Mary Jo said they were mean to Barry. They hurt Barry and whatever, but the babysitters had a counter story in there, and it just became, you know, they just stopped using that babysitter is basically what happened.
How old were you and how old was your sister?
I was 4, and she says 5 in the movie, but she was actually about 8.
How long did it go on?
It's hard to say. I would say over a period of weeks. It happened several times.
Mm-hmm. So it was your sister who brought it up with you that helped bring back memories and help you get to the point of talking?
Yeah, I mean, I was really at the end of my rope. I was in L.A. writing the Dennis Miller show, and I was and this is a scoop for you. I was a bit suicidal at the time. So, but then when she, you know, disclosed to me, then it all sort of pulled together. And I just realized that this pain I'd been walking around in and the self-loathing that I felt to make sense of the world because, you know, why did I feel like this all the time? It must be me. There must be something wrong with me. And so you go through a period after that where when you divest yourself of that, you're kind of hollow for a while, and you have to kind of – you feel like the wind's whistling through you. But eventually I, you know, began to fill that hole in, and then as a few years passed, I began to work on behalf of contemporary abused children. And that's how I ended up doing the confrontation of AOL about the child pornography trafficking that was going on. That was probably the turning point and the most healing thing I ever did.
So you wrote repeatedly to AOL and asked them to shut down these pedophile chat rooms.
Right, and they were making a lot of money on it. So they just found a lot, because back in those days, the modems were really slow.
Mm-hmm.
And so it took like a half hour to upload a, you know, low-grade picture.
We're talking dial-up era.
Right, right. And so it took a long time to upload each photo. And all these, and then if you're on AOL for more than 12 hours or something a month, they started charging you $3 or $4 an hour. So when you find, you know, thousands of people that are, you know, in the same chat rooms all the time, or I just realized, you know, I would go in there as an adult, you know, with my own AOL name, and people would just start sending me child pornography immediately. Like, no sort of, they just, that's what you're here for here. And they expected you to send child pornography back to them. And so I immediately contacted AOL, and they said, oh, thank you very much for being, you know, a bunch of corporate or net good citizen of our community, blah, blah, blah. But as time passed and I watched the problem grow exponentially, their answers became, you know, the back and forth between us just became more and more ridiculous.
So you eventually testified to the Senate Judiciary Committee. They were investigating child pornography, and you brought it to the area of internet child pornography, only to find that most of the senators on the Judiciary Committee had never been online. They didn't understand how the internet worked, and they didn't really comprehend the concept of a chat room. Right. So it was hard for them, is my understanding, it was hard for them to really comprehend what you were talking about. I mean, nevertheless, what was the outcome of, what do you think is the final outcome of your protest to AOL? You're testifying to the Senate Judiciary Committee, and you're going to, was it the DA's office in Cleveland?
Right. Well, yeah, the FBI picked up all the information from me. They picked up all the files I had. I know that some arrests were made because of that. I couldn't quantify it for you, but I know some arrests were made. As far as that company's concerned, I always feel that its cornerstone is very bloody. You know, they made a lot of money off those people, and they played it dumb for as long as they could. After the hearing, they were embarrassed. And after that, they went to a flat rate, too, so that might have been part of it. But they cleaned it up pretty quickly after that. So I publicly embarrassed them. But they stalled for a long enough time to make an awful lot of money.
So the man who abused you, who mm-hmm. knew your babysitter, and you're not quite clear what his relationship to her was.
Right.
You eventually found out he did time in prison for abusing boys. What did you learn about him?
I learned that he came from a tough background. He had spent a lot of time in the system as a child in foster homes and so on and so forth. And he had a terrible life. And although most people who are sexually abused as children do not become pedophiles, I'm convinced that almost all pedophiles were abused as children. And so when I wrote a piece for the Boston Phoenix about it, it got picked up by the Syracuse New Times. And this wonderful social worker from Syracuse had just been part of a case, and she had, well, a couple years earlier, that put this guy away for the last time because he died in prison. So I heard he was identified to me. We had his location. He was the guy, you know. And for all the damage he did, he certainly paid a big price and had a terrible life because of it. And so sitting around hating him is nothing I have a lot of time for.
Barry Crimmins is the subject of Bobcat Goldthwait's new documentary called Call Me Lucky. If you want to hear a longer version of Terry's conversation with Crimmins and Goldthwait, check out Fresh Air's podcast at itunes.com/freshair. The new movie, The End of the Tour, is adapted from a series of interviews between the novelist David Foster Wallace and a reporter for Rolling Stone, done after the publication of Wallace's 1996 novel, Infinite Jest, the book that made him a literary celebrity. 12 years later, in 2008, Wallace committed suicide. Our film critic David Edelstein has a review of The End of the Tour.
The Tour in The End of the Tour is based on David Foster Wallace's 1996 multi-city book promotion for his epic novel, Infinite Jest. And its end is the Midwest, where Wallace, played by Jason Segel, is accompanied by Rolling Stone magazine writer David Lipsky, played by Jesse Eisenberg, who's writing a profile of him. The actual profile was never finished, but after Wallace's 2008 suicide, Lipsky transcribed his interviews and published a book with the Wallace-like title, Although, of Course, You End Up Becoming Yourself. I don't think the book is especially revelatory. Wallace is extremely self-conscious, and many of Lipsky's questions center on what it feels like to be a hot writer, instead of the peculiar scramble of Wallace's book, Infinite Jest. But it's good enough to be the basis for a very good movie. The End of the Tour is essentially a two-character piece, a sort of My Dinner with Andre on the road, that evokes the fuzziness of Wallace's emotional life and his discomfort with being interviewed. Jason Segel, with long, messy hair and the trademark Wallace bandana, makes Wallace's self-consciousness expressive, even eloquent. Much of his writing centers on how people struggle to present themselves. And in a diner opposite Lipsky, Wallace raises the whole meta question of what is an interview.
You know what I would love to do, man? I would love to do a profile on one of you guys who's doing a profile on me.
Mm. That is interesting.
Or is that too pomo and cute? I don't know.
Maybe for Rolling Stone, but
it would be interesting, though.
You think?
I'm sorry, man.
What's wrong?
It's just you're going to go back to New York and, like, sit at your desk and shape this thing however you want. That, I mean, to me, it's just extremely disturbing.
Why is it disturbing?
Because I think I would like to shape the impression of me that's coming across.
I see.
Yeah.
I
don't even know if I like you yet. So nervous about whether you like me.
There it is. Wallace studies Lipsky, studying Wallace, while Lipsky labors to find his story. Does all this sound too pointy-headed? The end of the tour doesn't play that way. Screenwriter Donald Margulies is an accomplished playwright, and he's alert to every subtle, awkward negotiation for power. The director, James Ponsoldt, keeps the action loosely framed. These guys are pretending to hang out. But there's no dead air. Everything is fraught. Wallace tells Lipsky he doesn't want to be seen as the kind of person who'd want to be in Rolling Stone. He's afraid of celebrity, of becoming a cog in a culture that in infinite jest he likens to a drug. But he also says he wants it to be easier to go home with women after his book readings. He wants it, and he doesn't. He's self-deprecating as a way of hiding his competitiveness. Jesse Eisenberg, by contrast, puts Lipsky's competitiveness on the surface. When he interviewed Wallace, Lipsky had just published a novel to resounding silence, and Eisenberg shows him oscillating between jealousy of Wallace's sudden fame and a desire to live vicariously through it. Their contest comes to a head when they meet up at the Mall of America in suburban Minneapolis with two female friends of Wallace's, played by Mamie Gummer and Mickey Sumner. In a series of exquisitely orchestrated scenes, Wallace picks up on Lipsky's subtle sexual moves on Sumner and begins to seethe. Not all of the end of the tour is so understated. The movie cooks up a bogus moral issue. Will Lipsky follow the crude orders of his crude editor and ask Wallace if he'd been addicted to heroin? It's a non-starter. And the pacing falters in later scenes when Lipsky and Wallace are quietly enraged at each other. But even at its draggiest, the film makes you feel lucky to be in the same room as David Foster Wallace. And I was once, at his first big event, in 1996, at a packed East Village bar called KGB. He read two sections of Infinite Jest in an even, deadpan meter that made every absurdity sound utterly logical. I wish the end of the tour gave a sense of what it was like to hear Wallace read. The filmmakers cut away whenever he's about to. I know that prose can seem static and overly literary on screen, but I think Jason Segel could have used it as a springboard into the labyrinth of Wallace's mind. Why not show David Foster Wallace in the one arena in which he could be perfectly understood?
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed the new movie, The End of the Tour. We're going to listen to Terry's recent interview with Teresa Ann Miller, an animal trainer who for more than 20 years has prepared dogs and cats for roles in movies and television shows. Miller trained the lead dogs in the Cannes Film Festival award winner White God, which has just come out on DVD. Miller initially worked with her father, who also trained animals for the screen. They both worked on Babe and the Beethoven films. But White God is unlike any film she's done, perhaps unlike any ever made, in that there are scenes with over 200 dogs running in a pack through the streets of Budapest, and there are no special effects, no CGI. The story revolves around a 13-year-old girl and her dog, Hagen. They're both deposited with her father in his small apartment. In the film, there's a new tax on dogs like Hagen, who are not purebred and are considered inferior. Rather than pay the tax and deal with the unwanted nuisance of a dog, the father forces the dog out of the car on the entrance to a highway as his horrified daughter protests in vain. The film follows the now homeless Hagen, who meets other abandoned dogs. Hagen is forced to become vicious when he falls into the hands of a dogfighter who trains him and enters him into a fight. Hagen and other discarded dogs eventually seek revenge against the people who have mistreated them.
Teresa Miller, welcome to Fresh Air. I love this film, and congratulations on the work that you did with the dogs. It's really remarkable. So what were you told that the director needed from you when you agreed to do the film?
They contacted me to do this film mostly because of the how ambitious the project was. This wasn't necessarily a film with an animal in it. It was a dog leading the film and telling the story.
So what were you told to look for in the dogs? What were you told they needed to do?
They had to have an acting range that should go from the most lovable, playful, endearing pet dog to this little girl, Lily, and find himself helpless on the streets, insecure, helpless, uncomfortable, unknowing. And then at one point, he has to transfer and kind of become this knower of all, runner of the streets, guardian of the city. So it was a huge range that they needed him to portray, from his innocence right up to his vigilance in, getting his...
Revenge.
Sorry, yeah, his revenge, thank you. his revenge on the people that kind of harmed him earlier on.
So how did you cast these dogs? How did you go looking for them? How did you find them?
Casting the dogs was, I thought, incredibly difficult because Cornell wanted that one dog
that
would
director.
Stand out. I'm sorry, Cornell Mundrutsko is our director. And he was very, very clear that this one lead dog had to be different than the other 250 dogs around him, mixed breed. So there's the challenge right there, to find that one in a million dog. However, he needed to have a photo double just for the amount of work that was scripted in the script, you know. And so it was a two-in-a-million dog that we were looking for. And it was actually first based on his appearance, which sometimes it is here. That's kind of Hollywood, right? Hollywood via Budapest. It was appearance first. And, of course, we wanted to be sure he was great with kids. And this dog had grown up in a family with small children, what have you. And from then on, the challenge was exposing him to everything. He'd never been out of his front yard. He lived in a very small town in Arizona. Hadn't seen very many things, hadn't seen cars and traffic. And it actually added to our experience in Budapest and kind of added to Hagen's experience on film, seeing things for the first time.
The faces of the two dogs who you cast in the leading role of Hagen, these dogs' faces are so expressive. And when Hagen is forced out of the car and abandoned on the highway in the beginning of the movie, the dog looks so confused and so hurt and so sad. And he's there alone on the street, disoriented, as these like honking cars are driving past him at a high speed. It's just heartbreaking to watch. How did you get those expressions on the dog's faces? How do you get a dog to show emotion?
Everything that the dog does is a reflection of either my body language or my tone of voice. A lot of times, and the best example I can give you is in a lot of your obedience and Schutzen work, you give very, very direct cues, very one word and one syllable commands to the dog, and you get a quick reaction to what you're asking him to do, ultimately. So you would tell him to sit, stay, come, what have you. When you're working with animals in film, what we do is we use a much more relaxed attitude, a much more relaxed and loose personality in ourselves. So I might say, hey, get over there and stay. No, stay. Don't, go. Oh, look, you know. And that kind of keeps him looking and keeps him guessing. And keeps him, it gives him a little bit more range to be able to see what's going on around him, and yet I can keep his attention at the same time. In our commands, go over here, come, can you, good, lie down, good, look here, nope, hey, oh, what's over there, you know? And I might throw a little stone off to the left or to the right and give him something to look at and be confused by, And then I might change it real quick and say, hey, you should get up. Stand up, back up, back up, back up, look. And now he might look a little confused. And then I'll say, okay, you can come out. So just to give you an example with my tone, and I am speaking over the entire film. I mean, everything that we do with those animals, you know, they have to dub when we're working with the actors. They have to dub the actor's voices over because that's how you get the best performance from an animal, is by him being able to hear and see you and react to the different various commands that you're asking him.
How do you get a dog to look sad, to look lost and abandoned?
To look sad and lost, what I do is just talk very slow. Put your head down and leave it and just watch. And they might sulk their head down a little bit and sulk their ears down. And we even taught Luke and Bodhi how to put their tail down. And they both have very curly tails. And I even taught them, put your tail down. So he didn't look happy, and I'll just talk to him in that tone. And then I'll tell him to speak real easy, and he might give a little bit of a cry. And then I might tell him just to lie down and put your head down, keep it down. And he'll just react off my voice and off my body language and the kind of looks that I want him to get. And I might have my assistant co-trainer just shuffle the feet and a little bit in the ground and get him to look to the left and to look to the right. Everything done very low-key, very sad, very slow tone. The reverse of that, of course, would be, hey, look here. Good, are you a happy dog? Can you speak, speak, speak? And now his tail's wagging, and now he's up and everything. And at that same moment, I can say, now stop. And put your head down and watch. It takes a good couple of months to get to where we're in tune that way. And he knows to kind of mirror my voice and my body language.
Were the growls that were used and the barks that were used from your actual dogs, or were they dubbed from other dogs?
They were, interesting enough, I learned this at Sundance from my director again, and he said that the dubbing of the dog sounds actually came from a studio in Belgium, and he says it was two guys in a studio who did all of the sound effects for the dogs. I mean, we had recorded barks
and
growls.
Do you mean it was like two men going woof?
Literally.
That kind of thing?
For the dog fight, well,
really?
A little more believable, yeah. But,
well, I know.
But yeah, for the dog fight and everything, they laid all that in and the growling, that kind of situation, you know what I mean?
Wow.
And yeah, I was quite surprised. But everyone was saying, oh my gosh, the sounds were so brutal and everything. And Cornell says, actually, it was a couple of guys in Belgium in a studio who did
amazing.
The dog fight. And he said it was fascinating to watch. He says he couldn't believe what he was seeing.
So let's talk about the pack scenes. And I don't want to give away too much of the plot here, but there are scenes at the beginning and the end of the movie where there's a pack of over 200 dogs. Did you say 250?
Maximum was 250 dogs, yeah, yeah.
And these are like real dogs running in a pack down the streets of Budapest. I've never seen that many real dogs running like that. And they're running with a purpose. I mean, as the TV newscaster in the film said, they look like they're part of an organized army. And they kind of are, because they're out for revenge. So I know you didn't train the pack dogs. You trained the two dogs who share the leading role. But your dogs interact with the pack dogs. During at least one of the scenes where the pack is running, there are some people who are on the streets and are totally and understandably panicked. So you have people who are acting, because they're actors, acting as if, or stuntmen, whatever, but they're acting as if they're totally panicked. That could easily upset the dogs, right? So did you train the dogs to be comfortable around people who were acting as if they were panicked?
We did, but they didn't really, I mean, they just thought it was a party. I mean, they just, you know, in the early training, Arpad would have his trainers run through the packs of dogs and in front of the packs of dogs. And again, the screams are put in later. The music helps, you know, sell it. And the panic, a lot of it was shot, you know, a little bit separately. And the dogs chasing the woman into the car. And so the dogs just thought, again, it was just a big party. And none of them were going to attack anybody or to necessarily stomp on anybody. They were just running to get to their other set, because on the other side is where they were going to get all their treats and goodies. And so whatever obstacles were in the way, they would find their way around it, you know. So it actually worked out well to incorporate the people running ahead of them and running inside, you know, the pack as well.
For our listeners just tuning in, I'm talking with Teresa Miller. She followed in the footsteps of her father, training animals for movie and TV roles. They both worked on Babe and the Beethoven films. She trained the two dogs who share the leading role in the Hungarian drama White God, which just came out on DVD. It's about dogs who are abandoned because they're not purebred, and later they seek their revenge. You adopted the two dogs who you trained for the Hungarian movie White God. I can see very easily how you fell in love with them and why you'd want to keep them. Did you or your father end up living with the dog or dogs from the Beethoven films?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Oh, really?
Of course. Yeah. St. Bernard's at the house, Great Danes at the house growing up. Even stranger than that was, you know, my father did Cujo as well. And I grew up with these St. Bernards, you know.
Cujo is from a Stephen King horror novel.
Oh my gosh.
And the dog is bit by a bat and becomes this kind of like monster dog.
Yeah, and interesting was, yeah, he gets rabies, terrorizes this whole little southern, you know, western coast or what have you. And I mean, I'd seen him training the dogs, and I knew the dogs as pets, and never had any qualms. And I know he went to go do the movie, and he came back, and it wasn't until I saw the movie, I was honest to God, I was terrified of these dogs after seeing the movie. I just couldn't believe it. And it was then scary to go in the backyard at night and see one standing there looking at you. It just changed my whole, you know, and that's just amazing. I mean, when someone can do that, I mean, those are my pets. Those are my St. Bernards at home, and they got me to second guess them after seeing that movie. That was something.
But you got over it.
Oh my gosh, that movie was tough. Yeah, it was just really interesting how it, you know, you have to put the reality into it that like, no, these are your dogs. It's all good. It's all. But that was my dad's specialty, was doing the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde kind of characters. And he did it in the movie White Dog. That was a Samuel Fuller movie with a white German Shepherd, as well as Cujo and They Only Kill Their Masters and the Doberman Gang. I mean, that was his specialty, doing Amityville Horror, all of the dogs that did the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So this was my first chance to be able to do that type of genre that he'd done for so many years so well.
How did your father get into the business of training animals for movies and TV?
Originally, my father was a Air Force dog handler in Lompoc, California, here on the West Coast at Vandenberg Air Force Base. And he would train sentry dogs to protect the missiles at the Air Force Base because he was bored, basically. He didn't like working these night shifts with nothing to do but guard these missiles, and so he signed on to take on a sentry dog. And now he had his sentry dog as companionship and to help protect the missiles. But in his spare time, he would train the dog because he was also still bored and wanted to do things with his dog. So he actually got famous around town because he was this Air Force airman who had a sentry dog who would push a baby stroller down the street or dress up and wear a bonnet and do all these cute and clever tricks as well as guard the missiles. And he met my mother, who worked nearby there. He used to do obedience classes and what have you. And so she, of course, signed her dog up to get to know him. And once he got out of the Air Force and after I was born, he started contacting Franken Incorporated, Rudd Weatherwax, Carl Spitz, all of the trainers that were actively working with animals in film at the time. And finally got an offer after being persistent and bugging, he finally got Frank in to give him a chance and give him a dog to train to find out what skills he had. And one of those dogs was the original Benji dog who was in Petticoat Junction as Higgins. And he used to work on those shows with him. So that's kind of how he got started, was just apprenticeship and learning from working with the trainers that worked in that company. Handling various types of animals, and the rest is history. He finally got his own company in 1977 and ran his own company for, gosh, almost 30 years.
So you've trained cats as well as dogs to perform in movies. I think it's much harder to train a cat than a dog. How do you train a cat? What's the incentive?
Yeah, the incentive for working with a cat or a chicken or a pig or what have you, most of your animals that don't necessarily work for praise like a dog. I think a dog is the only animal that genuinely wants your attention and your affection and praise. Working with the other animals is typically working with a food reward. And it doesn't mean starve the animal. It just means that when the animal is in training, that he's learning while he's getting his breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So he's not being deprived in any way. It's just that while he's doing his learning, he's getting his regular meals. And so, and the difference also being on a project where I might have one or two dogs to play the role of the lead character, with a cat, you'd probably have four or five cats. Because, again, you don't have that food drive for very long. Once they get a little full, well, now they're not interested in working anymore. You know what I mean? And so now you would bring in the second cat to try to continue your day and work out for the rest of the scene. So it is quite different. It is quite different working with them, but you still can teach them how to retrieve, how to go to point A to point B, how to go and rub up on an actor. You've seen it in all your cat commercials or what have you. So there's quite a bit you can still teach them to do. It's just what they're limited to physically, you know, between their size and their physical abilities.
Teresa Ann Miller trained the animals for the Hungarian film White God, which has just come out on DVD. You can hear a longer version of her conversation with Terry on Fresh Air's podcast at itunes.com/freshair. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.